Toward the end of our talk the last time, we gave several examples about how attraction and repulsion work in the desire world. And some of those examples involved animals. And seers find that animals do have desire bodies. However, the desire bodies of animals are in a very early stage of development. Therefore, the desires of most of the animals are usually only the most rudimentary desires, the most basic desires, like the things for survival and for continuance of the species. It is true that the animal group spirit is quite developed, the archangelic being that works from the desire world, and each group spirit has an idiosyncratic nature or a mood of desire that is all its own, and that is the way it works into the characteristics that we know of the different species, whether they be fish or dogs or whatever. So the desires for animals are like the desires for food and for reproduction and so on. One doesn't find a dog being interested or even aware of the different use of light that Monet uses versus the different light that Manet uses. That's just not in the experience of the desire body of a dog. They have a totally different kind of experience. They don't have an intellectual life at all, so they can't tell the difference between Kant and Hegel if people are interested in things like that. It is the existence and the very nature of the rudimentary desire bodies of animals that is one of the most important reasons why most mystics are vegetarians. In the last talk, we said that the central realm of the desire world, the realm through which everyone enters the experience of desire, is the region of feeling. And we talked about the twin feelings of interest and indifference. These aren't the only feelings that there are, because we feel, that is, we sense in our desire nature all sorts of things. But these are the most important, because unless we have interest in something, we can't excite the twin forces of attraction and repulsion to produce an emotion or to produce a desire motivation to do this or that. So when there is a rudimentary desire body, as well as our more sophisticated desire body, there is the feeling of pain. It's very interesting that you have to have a desire body to feel pain. We talked about it a little bit in an earlier talk, that if you cut your finger, the cut is in the finger, but the nerves transmit it to the brain. The brain transmits it to the etheric brain, and through the etheric body, the pain is felt in the desire body because feeling is a function of the desire body. But it is the spirit that feels the pain. If an animal feels the pain, it isn't so much the individual animal, but all of the animals of that species feel the pain because that is the spiritual consciousness that works through the animal. This is quite an incentive for us, if we have any little bit of compassion at all, to not cause pain to animals. Now, this doesn't mean that because plants don't have desire bodies, they don't feel plant pain. There is some kind of reaction throughout the cosmos, and if we wantonly destroy plants, poisoning them and doing things like that, certainly something is experienced somewhere in the cosmos, but it isn't pain as we experience pain. it's obvious that the sense of pain does serve interest. If you're feeling pain, you're really interested in that object which is causing you pain. If you're ill or if you're injured or something like that, you want that pain to be over. So it's clear that pain is a big part of our feelings in the central region of the desire world. But with the animals, the way we treat them, we're causing unnecessary pain and uneducational pain. Like if we've been talking about the fox chasing the rabbit, if the rabbit gets caught, it certainly feels pain, but there's something educational in that. That in the chase, both the rabbit and the fox are learning something. They're having some experience. But there isn't very much of experience if a cow has to, or a steer has to just sit there and be fed and lay in its own manure because there's no grass or no place for it to be. That's a very unnatural condition. There's experience, but it's not the same kind of experience as an animal that's running free on the Serengeti Plain or something like that. There's a lot of experience. You know, you have to forage for your food, and things are learned that way. So one of the reasons students of the Rosicrucian Fellowship are vegetarians is that they do not want to cause unnecessary pain. In our future evolution, we owe an enormous amount to the animal kingdom for the sacrifices that kingdom has made for our development. Beside the pain and suffering to the animal, that animal knows. It has the region of feeling, or it couldn't feel pain, and it knows what's happening to it. So the flesh of an animal, a steer or a pig or something like that, is permeated with all kinds of desires of fear and agony. So that food has all of that as part of it when you are taking it into you. And there's still yet one more reason why, from a moral point of view or from an ethical point of view, why Rosicrucian students are vegetarians. The flesh of an animal is built within the desire body, especially the part that we eat. The part that we eat is the muscle. Everybody wants that red or white meat, and that's what allows the animal to move. The muscles respond directly to the desire nature because the desire nature wants that chicken to go foraging for that bug over there. And so the part that we eat are the muscles. And when they are being built, they are permeated with the desire stuff that is in the desire body of the animal. And that desire body of the animal is mostly occupied with the desire for food and the desire for reproduction. As a consequence, when we take in animal food, we are taking in food that has more of those desires permeating it, and we're adding to our difficulty of trying to live lives that are pure, that we don't live in the baser desires. A plant, on the other hand, is innocent of those kinds of desires, and when we take that kind of food into us, we are taking in something that is neutral, if not something that is beautiful in the sacrifice of the fruit of the plant or something of that nature. If we're really hungry, the desire for food is pure and it's unmitigated. But not all of our desires are that pure. Even the strongest of the most base desires, the desire for sex, for example, for reproduction, even that has all sorts of hitches to it. Especially as we have developed and we have begun to realize that maybe the way we abuse that and indulge in that is not really the best for us. For example, in the extreme cases, there is repression hysteria that Freud was the first to really note. And then, when those desires are held back altogether, and a person isn't trained in how to transmute those desires into something higher like healing, we have the perversion that is taking place in celibate priests. They're trying to be celibate. They don't know why. They're not trained into the principles of celibacy and the use of the creative energy for higher purposes. And they're trying to do something. They're just trying to not be sexual. And to not be sexual without turning that energy to something else is a very dangerous kind of thing. So they're trying to repress. And a desire, because it is in a higher realm than the physical world, that desire lives on and on. Again, a psychologist working with somebody can call back desires, and those desires are just as alive and as strong as they were 34 years before when they were first experienced. So it's a very powerful and undeniable creative force. Even the desire to feed ourselves, the other most basic desire. In fact, the parts of the brain that are used to tell the body that it needs or wants either food or sex are the parts of the brain that have the most blood flowing to them. Some people even use that for dieting. They say, well, if you want to lose weight, you don't want to be eating all the time, indulge in sex more because you'll be directing the blood away from the centers that have to do with food. It's a kind of a logic, but it's kind of crazy, I guess. But we have people trying to hold back the desire for food, and we have things like bulimia and anorexia and all of those kinds of things. We're trying to subdue something that is very necessary. The point that we're trying to get to in all of this is that when we're talking about desire and we're talking about when we assert ourselves to take something to us and it repels other people, or we sacrifice of ourselves and give to other people, which attracts them to us, it isn't always that simple. It would be nice if we could live that simply, but it isn't always that simple. We all experience hot and cold, push-pull relationships. I have a push-pull relationship with California. In some ways I love it, in some ways I hate it, but over the years my repulsion for California has gotten stronger than my attraction to it. So we have mixed motivations, all kinds of mixed motivations. Sometimes those mixed motivations become so balanced and so strong that we have a hard time doing anything at all. Even with simple motivations, we can have so many of them that it's hard to choose. We can be like a kid in the candy shop that we desire this and this and this and this, and there isn't possibly the time to be able to satisfy all of those desires. So when we're talking about the desire body, we're talking about something that in us is pretty sophisticated. We're complicated people. This complication, which is sometimes sophisticated, is not in itself a bad thing. I wouldn't want to go back to having the desire of an animal, even though it would be a simple, singular, untainted life of desire. There are people that are like that. They try to become mountain men or something of that nature, and they spend so much of their time in primitive existence that there's no time for anything of refinement or advancement or improvement. And besides, there's much more to the world than the simple desires. There's much more than eating and sleeping and sex. There's much, much more than that. We're in this evolutionary creation for experience. And if we slog our way through the cosmology of the Rosicrucian philosophy, even in the very brief way that it is stated, we can see that we go through millions and millions and millions of different kinds of experience. And each of those experiences brings out another potential. And in potential, the spirit is capable of many, many things. So we don't want to be monomaniacs, where we do only one thing and have only one thing. We want to, if evolution teaches us anything, it teaches us that variety is important. The ability to do many things and experience many things. Now, desire world experiences appear to be both horizontal and vertical simultaneously. Both in both dimensions, there are spectral desires. We talked yesterday, we used an analogy from physics when we talked about the physics of color. We said that if we have a color sphere with all of the colors of the spectrum around the equator of it, and that they represented hue, and the further we were out from the center, the more dense the color was, that represented saturation, and the higher one went, the more whiteness there was, so that the North Pole was completely white light and that the South Pole was completely black light. If you visualize that and you visualize yourself in the center of that, you can see that in the horizontal on that equator and every circle of latitude going either north or south, horizontally, there's a full spectrum. There is also a vertical spectrum in that the pure giving light that is at the top is like Jupiter, whereas the selfish, dark, separative, fearful, this is mine kind of consciousness is at the bottom of the color sphere, and that's sort of what the desire world is like. Now, it's spectral. Everything is everywhere in the desire world. It's unfortunate that you can only attend these evening talks, because this afternoon we started an astrological tour of the desire world, and we talked about the central desire world and looked at about 10 horoscopes that represented feeling and different people who used the principle of feeling in different ways. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the lower desire world, and we're going to use the simplest keyword astrology of Max Heindel. And we're going to show that the simple astrology of Max Heindel fits in perfectly, almost word for word, with the keywords that are used to describe the desire world in the cosmos conception. And on Friday, we're going to do the same thing with the higher desire world, where we talk about the nobler pursuits of human beings and the higher kinds of emotions that we can have. I wanted to do, but I didn't want to pig away all the time from everybody else, I wanted to do a third parallel series. I've mentioned it in the astrology series, and that, I believe, is one of the weaknesses of the Rosicrucian cosmo conception, but there's no way that it could be done without it being very, very lengthy. The way we're looking at the desire world right now is very mechanical. We're seeing the principles of attraction and repulsion, of giving or self-asserting. But those are very skeletal. When we live our lives out, it's the story of our lives. And our lives are made from ideas in the realm of human spirit, ideational abstract ideas. And those ideas are the morals of stories. Max Heindel tells us that the path of initiation is written in the stars. And if you look at the constellations, there are stories. And people over the centuries have made different lines of arc running through the different stories of the constellations. And each of them represents a line of consciousness, which is a different kind of initiatory kind of experience. The gods live out our lives in story form by living their existence within the ideational ideas. So, like, it's one thing if you live a life and in that life you experience a betrayal. And that betrayal is a very hurtful kind of repulsion. You've been rejected, and rejection is a very hard thing to go through. But the way it works, if you look at that only in terms of the feeling of rejection, you experience the experience, but it is the atmosphere that surrounds it, the story that is the history of your life that is important. Now, I think it's very important that if we have spare time and we want to spend it in an edifying way, that we read myths and stories and fairy tales and scriptures and all the stories that are in them, because in them we can see the morals that are the basis of our own history, life history. Our work here in this world is taking mythology or stories and through our experience making it the history. We can't do that in these talks because that would take an entire series of talks, and what we're talking about here is the most basic and the most fundamental, and we don't want to try to do too much altogether. The last evening we said that the central region of the desire world, which is called the world of feeling, which is where we entered the desire world, and when we have feelings, if we're interested, that interest excites us. And the way in which we take that excitement determines whether we are self-assertive or whether we are self-sacrificing. Now, the human desire body, which was developed or which was begun in the moon period, and in the moon period, our cosmos was nothing like it is now. The constitution was altogether different, and we went through an animal-like condition. We weren't like the animals we see around us because everything was all different then. We were animal-like in that we were learning motivation, and we were learning independent motility so that we could move around and not be rooted like plants. That lunar nature of the moon period, which is a vertical kind of quality, put its stamp on the desire body. So that if we look at any horoscope, the moon represents our ability to feel. There are other factors that enter in, but primarily the feelability or the excitability or the basic emotionality altogether is determined by the moon. So what we're suggesting is, if we're not clairvoyant and we want a way to get past the illusion of the external form, if we look at the moon in a horoscope, we can tune in on the feeling nature of the person whose horoscope it is. Similarly, the most basic keyword given in Max Heindel's astrology for Aries is self-assertion. And the most basic keyword that is given for Scorpio is repulsion. Both Mars and Scorpio Aries and Scorpio are ruled by Mars. Therefore, Mars is the most potent expressor of self-assertion and the repulsion that results from it. In some of these things, there's a delayed action. Like tomorrow, when we look at horoscopes, we'll see that some people are into a self-assertion, but that self-assertion hasn't gone so far as to be completely repulsive. Other people, it's almost all repulsion, and the self-assertion is already minimal. So Mars is emblematic of desire in the lower desire world. Analogously, Libra, the key word for Libra, one of the simplest, is giving love to the other. And Taurus, one of the most simple key words for Taurus, is attraction. So it's very obvious that Rosicrucian astrology and Rosicrucian philosophy are tied together, because in the self-sacrificial giving of Venus, there is attraction. And so the higher desire world is ruled by Venus. Okay, with these things in mind, we're now about ready to work our way back to the desire world and look at the structure of the desire world. Now remember, what we're doing is sort of like looking at the structure of a building when it's nothing but beams, maybe a few pipes and wires. The walls haven't been put up, the windows haven't been put in, and none of the fixtures that are going to be operative are there yet. We're just looking at the basic structure, as though we were looking at it with X-ray vision or something like that. In this case, it's desire vision. And again, remember, when you have desire clairvoyance, what you are seeing are emotions. You are seeing desires. And when you see desires, when you're tuned into a desire, when you feel that desire, it is the same feeling that you get when you look at a color of a given kind. The desire world is the world of color, but color is the form of the nature of feeling, because if you look only at the forms, you're going to miss the greater part of desire. Even in this physical world, if you look only at the form, you're going to miss the greater part of the human being, because the greater part of the human being is invisible and is not the form. Now, the lowest region of the desire world is called the region of passion and low desire. That seems to be an unfortunate choice in words, because the sacrifice of Christ, which is ultimately attractive, and that is probably one of the most powerful forces working in the world right now, is called a passion. And that is anything but selfish sexual desire or anything like that. So I think perhaps a better word could have been chosen than passion, but that's the word that we're working with, and we'll have to live with that for now. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy, cosmoconception especially, says this region analogously parallels the solids in the physical world. Remember, we mentioned yesterday that the physical world has seven subdivisions also, and that the deepest of them is the solids. And this appears to be a very important analogy, that the lowest part of the desire world and the lowest part of the physical world are alike. This impenetrable, opaque, subjective, separative area that we are in, all of those keywords that I just used now are keywords for Saturn. So the the lowest of the chemical division, subdivision of the physical world is ruled by Saturn, and the lowest division of the desire world is ruled by Saturn. This is why Rosicrucian astrologers, or astrologers everywhere, claim that the minerals, the dense minerals, are ruled by Saturn. Now, this dovetails very closely with a lot of our other experience. It dovetails with what we've said about the color sphere, but it gives us insight into the nature of desire, the desire world, and the desire body. Now, we've just been saying that self-assertion produces repulsion. We've said that that's only active in the lower part of the desire world. In fact, the lower one proceeds into the desire world, the more repulsion there is as a result of self-assertion. As we know, there is no honor among thieves. From this, we can see, putting together the fact of Saturn ruling the most low level, is that the selfish intent for objects, especially physical objects, and most especially physical bodies as objects, as the ultimate motivation for repulsive self-assertion. This goes along with our experience as selfishness resulting in the greatest kind of repulsion, hatred. I don't want to be around hateful people. I don't think anybody really does. Treachery and vengeance and all of those things are extremely repugnant. Because Saturn is the obvious and preeminent ruler of this region, doesn't mean that the other planets aren't there also. Because we just said that whole, no matter, even when we're down at the very bottom of the color sphere, all of the colors are there. Meaning to say all of the other planets are there too. Anybody who ever studied astrology knows there are all different kinds of flavors of selfishness. Even Venus can be drawn into selfishness in that in an insecurity about love that we can be repulsive in trying to have other people do what we want them to by using our Venusian wiles in a very selfish way. Well, I've got to be careful. These are very concentrated notes. It's also incorrect when we're thinking of Saturn astrologically to think of it only as evil. Because Saturn is active in all of the other regions also. And it operates in the other regions not necessarily in a selfish way, but in very positive ways. If you take even the most lofty region, which is the region where philanthropy exists, philanthropy needs organization. You can't take the wonderful, precious things that are given away philanthropically and waste them, so you need some kind of organization and structure. So it's incorrect to think that Saturn is always malicious or Saturn is always bad, even though it happens to rule the lowest part of the desire world. The fact that it is so often malicious is not a commentary on Saturn, it's a commentary on us and what we do with our lives. Even self-assertion and repulsion have some very positive features to them. They're important to our experience, and they're important to our progress, and they are important to the creation. Desire forms can't hang around forever. It's not quite like a house that you put more and more junk in until there's no room for putting anything in anymore, and then you go out and rent a storage cabinet and fill that up so that there's no more room. But in the desire world, there also has to be old forms have to be dissolved. Eventually, if the forms didn't dissolve, there would be nothing to build new desire forms with. It's not a constant state that there's more and more desire stuff coming here. Everything in the cosmos is recycled. There's no loss anywhere. It's used over and over again. So the old forms have to be dissolved. So, the way it works, or let's look at one way that it works in our experience. The seers of the Rosicrucian Order and their initiatory students, who are also seers, find that nothing is lost in the cosmos. This is why we give a person 3.5 days in complete silence and peace after the physical body has died, which is to say the spirit has withdrawn from it in its higher vehicles, because in that time all of the experience of the past life is reviewed, and that is too important to be wasted. Each time we take a breath, everything that is in the air, in the atmosphere around us, including desires and thoughts, are taken into our etheric vehicles where they are saved. And after we die, we see all of that. Now that's pretty technical to go into, and we really don't have a time to go into that now, but we can look at a few little simple things. After death, we exist in the desire world in our desire bodies. And what happens is, after we have reviewed the images of the last life, that review, that interest in those etheric images impresses them into the second lowest region of the desire world, which is called the region of impressionability. And there they become pictorial forms that have been created by our interest. But it doesn't end there, because we look at them. The word that is used is they're built in to the region of impressionability. If after death we maintain an interest, which we must do because we're living in a desire body that is made of those images, when we look at those images and see our actions for what they were, and see them as the world sees them, if we say in full honesty, yes, this is what I did. In the action of doing that, in what is called purgatory, if we own our deeds, we draw them to us, which is a form of self-assertion. I'm taking this to me. And what happens is those forms and all the forms that they are about in the desire world are then subject to repulsion. And with repulsion, they disintegrate. And consequently, there is a perfect recycling in the lowest regions of the desire world, and our purgatorial existence is not something magical. Our purgatorial existence uses the very simple forces of self-assertion and repulsion to undo what we have done, because we can't take everything with us. You know, it's the same thing is true for the desire world as it is true in the physical world. You know, the old joke that they say that you never see a U-Haul behind a hearse because you can't take things with you, and the same thing is the same thing is true with the desire world. You can't take all of your desire images with you also, and you have to be free of them. You have to extract the material, and you extract the material by honestly giving assent to them, giving your interest to them in such a way that you take them in, and then repulsion does its magic. Now, the region of impressionability is a very special region. There it is an equilibrium. There is an equilibrium between attraction and repulsion. Enough attraction to hold the impression together, enough repulsion so that it can be dissolved. And this is the status of things in the region of impressionability. Now, that equilibrium doesn't last forever. Remember, last evening we said that desire, in the desire world, what is all important is the intensity of desire. And if somebody makes something that, an impression that is extremely intense, that may hang around for hundreds or thousands of years. But even so, it doesn't last forever. Nothing like that lasts forever in the lower world. So it's a matter that one doesn't just die and become absorbed in spiritual things. We're still interested in the same things we were interested in before we died. And so we're interested in such a way that we're drawn back to things again and again and again. And that's where the dissolution takes place, is in the region of impressionability. The desire body just like the physical body, disintegrates when the will to live is withdrawn from the archetype that created it. There is an archetype for the desire body, just as there is an archetype for the dense physical body. And as the archetype becomes exhausted, then there is a disintegration. How well and how quickly the experience is extracted and processed is up to us. If we are good at it, we can process it even before we die. But it is always a matter of whether we are attached to what we have done and whether we are willing to own up to our desires and not hang on to them in attachment. You know, it's possible there are a lot of people that are attached to being a badass, and they don't want to give up that desire world image of themselves as badasses, and they hang on to them. And as long as we hang on to the desire, that desire will be with us. We talked about John Calvin. The seer, great seer Swedenborg, said that he spent an enormous amount of time in the purgatorial realms because he wouldn't admit that this was what it was like when you were dead. And because he wouldn't, he just had to wait and wait and wait. Because he wouldn't say, no, he had this whole idea that after death there was this lake of fire and all of this and all of that. He wasn't seeing that, so it really wasn't there. There is fire. Any desire that's unfulfilled is a pain, and it burns, but it's not, you don't think of it like a forest fire or something like that. I'm going to skip some material here because I think we've gotten some of the basic ideas. Yes. They exist as desire forms also. There's another example from Swedenborg when he worked as an invisible helper of a woman who always wanted a little cottage with a picket fence. And she died, and she always had that dream for a cottage with a picket fence. And in the desire world, she found herself with a cottage with a picket fence. And she was just as pleased as punch over it. And Swedenborg came up to her and said, you're dead now. You have to leave this. You can't stay attached to this all of your life. And she said, I'm not dead. I've got what I've always wanted. And she just wouldn't listen. And she had the desire. And then he said to her, imagine this is all gone. And she imagined it was all gone. And it was. And that was the shock that released her from being attached to an unfulfilled desire and an unfulfilled dream. Unfulfilled dreams and desires can be very dangerous things because you always promise yourself, like, someday I'm going to have... I can tell you a very embarrassing story about it. Where I grew up, it was in a part of Wisconsin that was very poor. And we all had sandwiches made with homemade sausage and homemade bread, except there was one rich farm kid named Howard. And he had lunches that were similar to ours, but he always got a Twinkie in his lunch. And he was such a guy that if he couldn't eat that Twinkie, he would just as soon grind it underfoot as give it to somebody else. And in myself, I said to myself, someday I'm going to have all the Twinkies I want to eat. And you can bet that when you give yourself that kind of a desire, it's going to be fulfilled someday. And I went on a Twinkie binge. And I ate a lot of Twinkies until I looked at the wrapper. I found out they had animal matter in them. And I thought, oh, no, I got to give up the Twinkies. But that's the sort of thing that happens with unfulfilled desires. They're just, you can be attached to them just as much as you're attached. There's something about if you complete that desire, it's easier to let go of it. It's one of those things that most of us in the room are past the center of life right now. And once you get past the center of life, you don't acquire more and more. You let go of more and more because you're satisfied with those things and you see that you've gone as far as you can go with them and there's nothing more to them, and you start letting go. That's already a part of the unwinding process. It starts once your children are born and you start looking backwards instead of only looking forwards in life. You're unwinding and you're letting go of more things. And that, you know, that's part of a process that goes on that way. So it is better to have a fulfilled than an unfulfilled desire. Even if it is a bad desire, you at least have the consequence of it, and you can see it, what it was and what it really meant. Yes. When you draw it into you, the essence of it becomes the soul material. And when you take it into you, that is kind of self-assertion as the dog pulling the bone to himself or the food bowl to himself and growling to keep other things away, except in this case, the whole form is what goes away and it goes into the lowest region and it's dissolved there. They wait there until they let go. You might hang on and on and on. In some cases, Max Heindel tells us, in some cases, people never let go. And what they do is they take them out of their desire bodies anyway, because chances are they aren't going to learn anything from them, and they put them through a life cycle with that some of that material not learned from, and then they come back in their next life, and usually when they are around 14, when puberty comes in and desire body is born again, the old desire body gets attracted. And there's a name, it's called something different now, but it used to be called dementia praecox. And there's a kind of schizophrenia that happens at age 14, anywhere between age 14 and age 18, that is one is very, very divided in their desires. And if you could look with clairvoyant vision, you would see that it is because they have two desire bodies, the new that has been learned from the life cycle in between and the old one that hasn't been dissolved from before. So so they're missing that. So they're in a tough place, and that's why it results in insanity, because they don't have the soul power from that desire body because they never extracted it, because those desires were so hard that they weren't going to let go. And here they're presented with very divided motivation, and with that kind of divided motivation, yeah, that's a tough goal. Okay. Yes. In fact, it happens. We talked this afternoon, we looked at the horoscope of Bulwer Lytton, and he describes the process that in Orthodox Christianity is called eternal damnation, which is a very frightening thing. But it so happens that the spirit, if it builds a lower nature with that pseudo-self in that lower nature, and that becomes very strong, and it takes the archetype of each new life and perverts it into something harder and harder, it becomes completely unmanageable by the spirit. And the spirit has to withdraw, and it's out of the whole creation after that. And then that elemental that has a concrete mind, a desire nature, an etheric nature, and a physical body that it can perpetuate for thousands of years runs around as a terrible monster. If you read the novel, which Max Heindel recommends, it's called A Strange Story by Edward Bulwer Lytton. I have copies on the shelf here, at least one copy I have. It's very good literature. He's an excellent writer. He wrote three good spiritual books, one called A Strange Story, one called Zanoni, and one called Vril, or The Coming Race. And Max Heindel, Rudolf Steiner, Madame Blavatsky all thought extremely highly of this author. To write some of the things he wrote, he had to have had clairvoyance, because he can state them so clearly that you see graphically inside of you what's going on. But this is going to be an awfully long talk. What?
Edgar what? The name?
Bulwer Lytton. Edward Bulwer-Lytton. Oh boy, we really got slowed down now, be lost. We're coming to that. We're working our way through the whole desire world. That's why we're... One of the ways this process works is when we are going through the purgatorial process in the desire world, we see our desires outside of ourselves as though they were the product of someone other than ourselves. And this is extremely important because we've said several times in these talks, and you're going to hear it several times more, that the desire body and the desire world is extremely object-oriented. There is a subject that is desires in one way or another an object. We don't desire nothing. We desire an object. Whether that is an object of art that we are giving our entire sense of beauty to, or whether it is something that we're trying to take to ourselves because we're insecure and we feel that we need that to be complete beings. So the perspective in the desire world after death is reversed. In fact, we experience that quite a bit even with dreams. Very often our dreams are saying the opposite of what they really are. You know, like there have been books written on the subject of dreams, a certain number of dreams being the opposite of something. Now, what happens if life after life we see things first from the inside out and then from the outside in, because we have to do it both ways in order to neutralize him so those forms can be dissolved, we get a very objective view of things. And so the desire world is extremely objective and it is extremely moral. It isn't moralistic. It doesn't try to teach this is good, this is bad. It's moral in that you know exactly what the consequences of living with desires of this kind are. It's perfectly objective. And it's perfectly moral. We learn the thing about it. And there's no punishment. The only thing is retrieving what we have put out. Punishment is strictly a human thing. And it's strictly a thing that comes from fallen human beings. The universal spirit just has us experience things and has us experience them in truth. And that is the very beautiful nature of desire. Now, the objective nature of the desire world is helpful to our whole evolutionary process. It helps us as emotional beings. It helps us as we work with our desires of commission. And it helps us if we have not acted on our desires. We see what it's like to omit acting on our desires and not getting involved in things. Now, there are things that are called victimless crimes and what you could call victimless sins. Sins that don't hurt anybody, so it seems. Sometimes when things are not going well for us and we have problems and issues to deal with, the normal thing we do is we try to imagine solutions to those problems. But sometimes we want to take a vacation. And when we want to take a vacation, we withdraw from our problems because it's really nice to enter into a daydream. And that daydream doesn't solve the problem, it tries to make it disappear. So that if we daydream, wouldn't it be nice if there were no angry people in the world? Wouldn't it be nice if there were no selfishness? And some of our daydreams, we call them fantasies, can get pretty elaborate. But that's a form of non-action. That's a kind of selfishness. It's a mild selfishness. And it seems to be victimless. But we all know there's that old maxim that says, if wishes were horses, then beggars were riders. Meaning to say that if all of our wishes or if all of our daydreams came true, we would have something. But we actually don't have something. So what happens is we're talking here about the next level above the region of impressionability. That is called the region of wishes. Now, in this region, the self-assertion is not so prominent. So the attraction which runs throughout the desire world is gaining the upper hand. So there is an attraction, but a small amount of selfish self-assertion. And so we produce fantasies. We produce wishes. Now, because the region of the region of wishes abuts the central region, the region of feeling, which is ruled by the moon, you have sort of a double whammy. You have the imaginative quality of Venus, which is attractive, plus you have the impressional drawing quality of the moon, which has its own kind of attraction. So it's very easy to make fantasy after fantasy after fantasy, and they become very, very elaborate. Now, imagination is a really important thing. And the moon and Venus are two of the most imaginative planets of all. But the imagination is fine as long as it's used in service, as long as it's solving a problem. Even if it's solving a problem in a wrong way, at least you're doing something and not just laying back in wishes. Thus, a person is weakened and even more insecure and more irrelevant from experience. So what appears to be a harmless or a victimless kind of sin is actually not only hurting that person, it's hurting the whole cosmos because one is not doing something. One is not holding up one's end. One is not passing the baton on to someone else. Ooh, I'm very tired. This is very hard set of notes. The more we succumb to daydreaming, the more it becomes habitual until it eventually becomes so habitual that we're lost and can't do anything. And there are other problems to this, because when our fantasies, which are not intended to be real, meet the real object, there's a clash. There's a reality clash. And there's much more to that clash than you might think. We've often heard the statement that a lie told enough times actually weakens the truth. And when we indulge in fantasies or dreams or wishes or such like that again and again and again, we're weakening the true reality. And it weakens us at the same time. So this is why Rosicrucian students like Max Heindel, a Rosicrucian initiate, says that a lie, which is what a daydream is at the same time a murder and a suicide. It destroys the object of reality by putting up a false reality, and it weakens itself so that it is not functional as it should be. So projecting a very detailed and elaborate fantasy can also be like laying a pitfall on the forest floor. It looks like everything is continuous. Now, if you look around out there, I'm not highly up on these things, but I'm pretty much up on a lot of different things. But there are a lot of religions out there that are nothing but fantasy. And some of them are there for the buck. Some of them are there to aggrandize people to say, wow, look at, I'm your new guru or something like that. But they're nothing more than pitfalls. They're almost laughable when you run into some of them. And people are investing their lives in something that is nothing more than a fantasy. Of course, they'll learn a lesson when they fall down into the pit. They'll learn a lesson, but this is not a very good thing to do, and this is a thing that is very prevalent in the world. This is why the statement at the very beginning of the Cosmo conception is, try the spirits and find them wanting. Try all things is what the Bible says, and this is a very important thing. Now, we've already talked about the central or the fourth region of the desire world, so there's no reason to go into that. So let's try going into the higher desire world for a little bit and see what the basic structure is like. Again, we must remember that all of these desire things live lives, and those lives are like stories, and those stories produce forms. There are times when Max Seindel, he doesn't indulge in it much, and he doesn't really indulge. He does it to show us particular lessons, but he shows us all of those strange, strange forms that are in the desire world on different levels. I had a friend who saw something in the lower desire world he could never believe. He saw a being that was something like a horse, but it had arms, and that its arms kept going back up over to the spine of its horse-like body and ripping it in half and pulling it apart. And he looked at this for hours, and he'd let it go, and it would happen all over. You know, there are all sorts of, you know, what we're looking, I'm only reason I'm saying this is not to be phenomenalistic, but to say that what we're talking about is filled with all kinds of forms. And it's filled with all kinds of stories, with all kinds of variations. And if you want to enter the desire world in full consciousness, you better be strong in your own being. You better not be taken out of your equipoise. You better be poised and strong and faithful so that you can face almost anything, because just the seeming chaos of the desire world is enough to discombobulate almost anyone. We mentioned it in the class this afternoon that Max Seindel tells us that when an invisible helper wakes up fully conscious in the desire world as an invisible helper, even whether they don't leave the body in full consciousness, it takes a half a year sometimes before that person can be used as an invisible helper, because they are so disoriented from so much happening that they have to get their feet again. All right, a few minutes ago we talked about figuratively that the region of wishes abutted the region of feeling. The space is a different kind of space. Like, for example, if you see someone with desire vision at the same time you're seeing them with physical vision, you see the physical body, but at the same time you see it's another kind of space in the same area where the physical body is, but it's not part of this world. It's a different realm altogether. We talked a little bit about Nikola Tesla's chart and how when he was a child, he had a hard time matching up the inner vision with the outer vision because they were from two different worlds, and it took him a long time to be able to bring them to bring a complete understanding between what was happening between the more inward and the more outward. So when we're talking and saying that the region of soul life, which we're talking about now, abuts the world of feeling, we don't mean that, you know, like it's next door, like, you know, 306 is next to the 308 and 304. It's a different kind of proximity. We have to always remember that the desire world is a world of emotion, and closeness is a matter, or proximity is a matter of feeling. The adjacency of the lunar center of the desire world and the Venusian world just above it gives the quality to the fifth region of the desire world of being very, very imaginative. But the imaginative quality does not have the self-assertiveness, and it therefore does not have the repulsiveness and the breaking down qualities of the lower desire world. Eventually, when those forms are used up, usually lower beings take them and in some way do destroy those forms, but that's also part of the same creation. So there's none of the repulsion due to selfishness. This means that the imagination is unchecked, and it is very, very benign. From astrology, we know that the moon is the great cosmic mother. It nurtures and it fosters and it protects, and that it attracts in a different way than the Venus qualities attract. For example, all of the water from the earth is absorbed up into the trees by capillary action, or lunar herbs such as something like what is a good lunar herb? The one that you put on for poison ivy, it just draws it all off. Jerry, I just talked about it last week. The stuff out of barnyards. No? Chickweed. Chickweed is one of the strongest lunar herbs of all. So drawing is the quality of Venus and the moon together. Whether it is the kind of drawing, like if we draw sketches on the board, or whether it is somebody draws a good crowd, drawing is the right word. This is called the region of soul life, meaning the psychology or the emotional life expressed in colors is the life. It is everything is in reality is stated in emotional tones. The Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that the action of this region is art, which could be misunderstood, because if you're not careful, these words are very big. It's more than what we call art. The soul of art is imagination. It composes things. It draws things together. And it produces beautiful, lovely forms. But those forms are not only lovely, they are benign, they're helpful, they're useful. Most of the composition is in the form of schools, because people, as they're making their way back to the universal spirit, have an opportunity to learn. Everybody likes learning new things. And there are people that can use the imagination in a positive way to produce living lessons, to compose things so that you can't help but to learn them. Max Heindel gives all kinds of examples of toys and things like that that people who work in this region make for children who have died in childhood, and before they come back to birth, they have toys and experiences that they can learn object lessons in morality so that they can come back in a better state than when they died as children. So the composition here is for mutual improvement, because it's not for self. We're in the part of the world where everything is attraction. This is a whole different way of life. Here we sometimes have to look out for number one. But when you're functioning in the desire world, a higher desire world, you always look out for the other person. You give to the other person, and any kind of thing, security or anything that you might need, you just have to live by faith. You just have to give. And the thing of it is, you're filled with love and you want to give. Now, by function, the region is called the region of first heaven. This is because this is where one experiences all of the positive desires after birth. It's also called the region not only of art, but it's called the region of soul life, because the essence of life is giving. And if one is not giving, one doesn't have anything. This light doesn't give, and it's giving plenty of heat. I know it. I'm sorry, but I can't see without it. This light would disintegrate if it tried to hold all the energy to itself instead of emitting and giving it out. And so if this is a kind of living where you give completely by giving. Now, much earlier, we said that the loving and giving to another was symbolized by the sign Libra, or Libra, and that is what produced the attractive force. In doing this, something happens, that when you start giving, you're raised up. I don't know how to say it anymore. It's like the light brings you to a state of lightness. It's described very beautifully in Divine Comedy by Dante as he's going through the different heaven worlds. When he wants to rise to a new level, he looks at the face of Beatrice. And every time he looks at the face of Beatrice, he's uplifted. And the more we give, the more we are filled with those attractive feelings, and we're raised to higher levels. What happens is that when one composes things for others, one becomes progressively more loving to others. And eventually, it becomes all love for others. And the name or the word for that all love for others, where that goes beyond the imagination of things for others to just the love of the others all alone, the name for that is altruism. So the sixth region, or the next region up, is the region of altruism. It is to love others in complete friendship with no restraint, and this is the love that Christ gives at the very end of his life. He says that you are mine, they will know that you are mine in that you love one another. And in the same area of his St. John's Gospel, at the very end, he says, ye are my friends. Even the Last Supper is celebrated out in an upper room, outside of which there's a man with a pitcher of water. So the whole idea, you know, of the Christ consciousness is altruistic living. Now, we've been saying all along that the experience of the desire world, that is the experience of emotion and of desire, is color. But there's one thing that is common to all color, and that is light. So that when we get to the consciousness where one is living exclusively for the other, not even so much in the imagination, but that the other is what counts and becomes an altruist, that region is called the region of soul light. Because you're into something that is common to everyone, that everyone experiences. So it's not a contradiction, but even these realms can be perverted. That is, if one tries to live for the other and isn't completely self-sacrificing, what happens is sometimes the light gets perverted, and this is the realm from which misguided altruism becomes homosexuality and perversion of those things. This is, again, exactly the way Max Heindel says that these things come out. I'm going to have to cut short because we're getting way, way, way too long. The seventh, or the highest region of the desire world and the individual desire body, if we're lucky, is called philanthropy, the region of philanthropy. Now, every astrologer knows that philanthropy is ruled by Jupiter and Sagittarius. And the Greeks called Jupiter Zeus. And the name Zeus is perfect because it means all bright. It means all light. In the material world, philanthropy means that we give money. In the desire world, it just means giving. Giving anything, giving everything to everyone or every other thing. So we can see a progression, a logical progression between all of the different regions of the desire world. This is called the region of soul power. Again, this is just like we said yesterday, the most subtle love, where there isn't even a subject in a way, that it, and the object is everything. That's a very subtle kind of consciousness to be able to spread your desire to everything in the cosmos. Jupiter is universalizing. We're coming closer to the spirit. And in the highest regions in the desire world, we are as close to the spirit as we can possibly get. And in that, we are totally giving, and we're the most subtle we can get. And the more subtle something is, the more powerful it is. Some people even misuse this, because in giving, you can have a great power over somebody else in giving. But in general, if this kind of love is applied, that the giving is the all, it raises one to as high of a level of supernal emotion as a human being is capable of experience. Now, if we take a step back and take a wide-angle view of everything we've tried to look at, we see that several things become clear. First, the forces of repulsion and attraction that rule the lower and higher worlds around the desire world, and their objectives are selfish and self-satisfying on one hand and selfless and other-oriented on the other hand. So we can see that Jupiter's at the top, Saturn is at the bottom. For a want of time, we don't have much time to go into the full spectrum of each region. But it might be a nice thing to take a color wheel and think about each of these stages. What I've done in this talk is just sat down and tried to see the logical or the psychological connection between each of the worlds. It's an equally valid thing to do. It's very edifying to see how the full spectrum, by using astrology, to see what the full spectrum of altruism is with all of the planets. When I put all the each planet one by one together with Uranus and get to understand that. Because we want to become full and whole people. It is our duty to the Creator. It is our duty to every other evolving spiritual being that we become the very best people that we can be, that we glean as much experience as we can glean. And it is possible with these kinds of things, even without external actions, but better if there are external actions, to be in touch with the different kinds of emotions and the different kinds of desires so that we can be very whole people and so that we can understand the psychologic. And I can guarantee you that if you start thinking about the spectrum of each of these realms and the way things function, you're going to run into people who have problems with them. And you're going to have the opportunity to prove what you know, what you have tried to learn about the desire world by helping people with their different problems. What you do, it's no different than if you prepare yourself to be a runner. When you prepare yourself to be a runner, you're going to run. You're not just going to sit there on a treadmill or something all the time. You're preparing yourself to do something. And if we prepare, part of our life is service. But we can't stay at one level of service. We have to become better and better servants. And if we begin to understand our motivations, especially to get away from the very selfish desires, so that we really care about other people, the more quickly we're going to grow and the more quickly we're really going to be able to help other people. So we've begun to talk a little bit about mixed motivations and their seeming difficulty to work with. We've talked a little bit about gaining objectivity. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to be complete people with all of the emotions, all of the desires, and free and freely and with will to focus on a given emotion to be able to express it. This is what I believe Christ means when he says, let your eye be single. We want to be single. We don't want to be divided in our emotions. We want to be able to deal with all kinds of complexities. We want to be single in our emotions. And when our singularity in emotion is the service of Christ, we cannot fail. Tomorrow night we'll talk about the problem, the great problem in the desire world and the desire body. And this is the one that every student always has to deal with. And that's tomorrow's lecture is tomorrow and Friday. The talks are about what the whole series was designed for. The first three talks are just building us up so that we can objectively and very carefully see what the problem is that we have to deal with in our own psychology, in our own ethics and morality. Oh, yes, sorry. Let's close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. B, all right, it's a hyphenated name. B-U-L-W-E-R hyphen L-Y-T-T-O-N.